Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to another episode of Smart Coaching on USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. We are marching through the season, and we've had some topics where we focused on some of the things that athletes deal with, especially pertaining to stress. Today, we're going to focus a little bit more on the athlete's experience and their perceptions of what effective coaching is. And, you know, I think in my experiences and in recently, I think it's been a little bit more observation and seeing some of the coaches that my son and daughter deal with in their experiences and what they think of them. And I kind of see two different ends of the spectrum. I see that coach who is real good with the kids and they like them, but when it comes to what they get from them out on the field and helping them succeed and his understanding of the game, there's something amiss there. So it's that guy who, you know, has some great rapport with kids, but doesn't have the technical tactical knowledge to help them out. And then I see on the other end of things, that guy who really has that stuff and understands the technical tactical, but creates an experience that in some ways starts to go negative with the kids because he doesn't have that rapport. So I think we want to look at some of those things today and the behaviors we have as coaches, as well as what our athletes' perceptions are of those things. So joining me on the podcast are our co-hosts, Dr. Brian Garrity and Dr. Clayton Kuklick. Guys, great to have you back here again.
Yep, good to be back again for another week. This is a great topic for us. I've got some my own dissertation research. I have studied this area, you know, just like a lot of young coaches trying to figure out how to get better. That's how I kind of got into this area. So I should be in for a good one.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. Looking forward to a good discussion today. I think it was kind of interesting how you brought up some of your observations in relation to some coaches having lots of technical knowledge and then other coaches without having the character developing pieces, and then other coaches contrastly developing lots of life skills and developing the athlete, developing relationships, but not having a lot of knowledge in regards to technical and tactical knowledge. And interesting, I was reading some papers just recently on effective coaching, and that's pretty much consistent in the research when they're looking at what effective coaches do, and they're actually able to do both of those things that you discussed, except it's integrated. That is, they have technical and tactical knowledge, and they also bring in this life skill development, team cohesion, and developing relationships with players in an integrated type approach. So that makes them effective, and they have positive outcomes as a result. So I thought that was interesting that your observations kind of jive with what the research is suggesting in relation to effective coaching.
Well, I think that's the objective of any coach, is to be able to do all of those things in that regard. But I know when you look at somebody developing in the profession, I think they're going to have strengths and weaknesses along the way. And it's all really about developing yourself. And I think some of that is being able to reflect on where you are right now. But Brian, let's get into this with you. You've done a lot of research on this, so I'll go ahead and kick it over to you and let you set this up for us.
Yeah. So I'm glad you started some of the youth stuff or your observations, because we'll circle back to the youth sport experience. And that's kind of like the nuance or the differentiation here is, in part, you want to look to see, well, what does the literature say about positive experiences at different levels? So for a youth athlete compared to high school and collegiate professional, master's athletes too is a growing body of area of research. So how do you coach those people and those adult athletes a little bit differently? So the research is kind of heading in that direction. Past research, some of the early stuff on athletes' preferences was mostly survey-based. There was a longtime sport management professor named Pekanathan Chelladurai. And his research started out of business, and he modified some instruments and was passing out surveys. And he developed an instrument called the Leadership Scale for Sport. And it was a behavioral instrument of assessing athletes' preferences and perceptions of coach behavior. And then he would also give it to the coaches to do a self-check to assess their own behavior. And interestingly, it's not uncommon in a lot of the literature to find differences between what the coaches perceive themselves and how the athletes perceive the coach. So again, you know, reconciling that we don't all have the same experience in sport is something to deal with. So Joe Dry's work started in, and he looked at five factors, and of those factors, and this should be no shocker, but it's interesting just to stop and think to how are we developing our coaching knowledge and skills to facilitate these areas. So Joe Dry talked about training and instruction as being a preferred behavior. Like coaches or the athletes want they want to learn from their coach. They want to get better. They want quality instruction. They want to get some decision-making, some democratic behavior. They want to have some part in that process of that. They don't want a coach that's completely autocratic or authoritarian. Thinking about some of the research in parenting, you don't want generally to be overbearing or an authoritarian parent. We haven't really used that research to guide coaching research yet, though, which could be actually pretty interesting to give a little bit different of an insight and different take on it, too, to see if it is similar. So training instruction, we think democratic behavior. I think Childrai called it either positive feedback or positive reward. And these are those interpersonal characters and styles that are more caring, more positive, uplifting, encouraging. Jives with other research as well. And I'll talk about some of that here in a sec too. What else with Childrai? I have to pull it up to see what the other one was. I think the other one was maybe scolding or management type of behavior, and those are least preferred type of behaviors.
Yeah, and the other one I would throw in there was also like developing rapport, positive athlete relationships, and developing cohesive units. And we kind of talked about that in some previous podcasts on cohesion and how to go about doing those things, and those are behaviors of effective coaches.
The last one that now you brought it up was social support. That's how you defined it.
It was funny, Keith, because I knew you were talking about like tough love a while back, and now that we're kind of on that little bit of that topic, I was just reading a research paper a month ago. I was actually thinking about you. You sometimes hear that word come up, that buzz term of tough love, and it was actually related to effective coaching or perceptions of effective coaching. And it wound up being that that whole tough love thing wound up being a characteristic of poor coaching. And they had different criteria or how they evaluated like poor coaching. And one was actually winning percentage was one of those variables that they kind of classified someone as a poor coach or whatever. But the point was that tough love, that militaristic, like I'm trying the approach where we're trying to toughen up athletes by being hard on them was actually an not effective approach. In comparison, the more effective coaches developed rapport, gave a little bit of autonomy, and engaged in some of those behaviors that Brian was just discussing in regards to that leadership scale that Brian was talking about.
Well, I think we see that in general, that I've talked about this on the podcast with a few guests, the idea of command and control really is dead in coaching, and maybe it worked at one time. I'm not quite sure, but I guess it's something that's really no longer acceptable in our athletes' eyes, and they don't respond well to it. So when we have those athletes experiencing maybe abuse or microaggression or whatever it might be, those are not preferred behaviors, and they don't respond well to it. So I think that goes right along with what we're talking about here in regards to that idea of tough love.
Yeah, and it's important to differentiate abusive behaviors, things where physically, mentally, emotionally, sexually as well. And we've got to be able to say those things because they happen, it occurs. We need to be mindful of it. Actually, a local school district here just had a $12 million settlement on a sexual, not for a coach, actually, it was a teacher. But you know, these things happen. We see it in sports. We've seen it in collegiate sports lately, too, and at the Olympic level. Abusive behavior is a higher, much higher threshold than philosophical discussion on effective coaching or quality coaching. In no way is degrading language, physically touching somebody inappropriately, hurting them, saying things to them, or sexually assaulting them or touching them then inappropriately there as well. None of that is ever acceptable, just as a ground marker. We're not talking about expectations and you know, how to build resiliency or tough love and how to push somebody past maybe what they think they can do. Those are kind of clear-cut differentiator markers that we're not going to discuss ambiguity in that. It's important to continue to think about those things and prevent them. It's not really open. I think that hopefully the debate on that, on the acceptability of those things is closed.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting, too, because we have these like terms that we use, right? So we have poor coaching, we have abusive coaching, and then we have on like this other end of the spectrum, it's like effective coaching.
Great coaching.
Yeah,
positive coaching.
Positive coaching. And it's like, what are all these things mean? And maybe this is a good segue into some of the research on what effective coaching actually is. And a couple of years ago, the International Council for Coaching Excellence put together, a research team to kind of synthesize what actually effective coaching is, because synthesize the research on what that actually is. Because if we think about that, what is effective coaching? Is it winning percentage? Is it getting athletes to obtain certain outcomes? Is it having a certain amount of athletes reach collegiate level or professional level? And what they actually did was synthesizing some of that research, and they did use winning as a marker, but in conjunction with other things. And kind of what they came up with was, again, synthesizing many different research papers on this particular topic, is that effective coaching are coaches that use professional, interpersonal, and interpersonal knowledge to develop athletes' competence, connection with others, and their character, which kind of brings into that life skill development. And that's kind of broad, but we can drill down on some of those perhaps different outcomes and future podcasts. We can look at how to develop that coaching knowledge in order to engage those outcomes. So maybe you want to speak to your definition on poor coaching then, just to give a kind of comparison of the two.
Yeah. So Keith, in the research world, before I can already hear somebody in a podcast, a listener going, pointy-handed academics can't figure anything out, pin it down and give a good definition. There's a couple of issues. One, philosophically, these are enduring questions. They're open for debate and dialogue, which is great because it's going to extend our thought process and our thinking, and it's going to relate to our practice as well. And that's how coaching has changed and will continue to change, hopefully, and will make progress in the years to come. In part, some of the researchers have do these things, and they ask different questions because they're going to get different findings. So like my research and my dissertation, I asked athletes about their experience of poor coaching. So I interviewed 16 athletes about what they thought a poor coach for them, what their actual experience was. So I just said, if you felt like you ever had a poor coach, I want to interview you. So I interviewed 16 athletes. They talked about 32, 33 coaches or so. And that's all I started. I just started with a very open, broad question. That's different than the other work that was a survey study that gets responses back that are 1 through 5. We call it a Likert scale. You know, this is what I prefer, or this is what I perceive, and tries to quantify it. Andrea Becker, who was a classmate, colleague at the University of Tennessee with me, she did her dissertation on athletes' experiences of great coaching. And so that's actually what I wanted to study, but she was ahead of me in school, and she knocked it out before me, which was great because her research, too, picked up on adding to the literature, because we've looked at what is coaching and the coaching behaviors and try to develop heuristics and typologies to understand that. And then she got at what do athletes want, or what do they think a great coach does? And then I came along 2 years later and published on poor coaching. So the key things that she found, and she summarized it in a book chapter later, there's a handbook of sport coaching. It's a tour de force. There's my big academic term for the day. It's a long textbook on a lot of things about coaching. And it tells, there's a lot of references. So it's a broad summary. But in that chapter, she reviews some of the literature and she talks about 7 qualities or 7 behaviors of great coaches. And so she says they're positive, they're supportive, they're individualized, they're fair, they're appropriate, and they're clear. And by comparison, in my research, the findings show that athletes talked about poor coaches as not teaching, offering bad instruction or no instruction, not being individualized, saying the same things to everybody, not being knowledgeable. Poor coaches were uncaring, they were unfair, they inhibited key psychological qualities. And then also, this was quite an unexpected finding, that the athletes talked about coping, and that if I had a poor coach and I wasn't getting quality instruction, or I wasn't getting cared for, or he was messing with my confidence or giving me too much anxiety, here's how I responded in order to try to succeed. And in spite of poor coaching, this is how I dealt with it. So there's kind of our last 15 years or so of research in about 5 minutes.
We look at some of those things. And again, we're talking about this from the athlete side. How much becomes important to them in terms of they feel like they're being cared for, that they're in a caring relationship with that coach. I think you brought up something I think very important there, that there really can't be that one size fits all approach to coaching. I know, you know, and I think back to my son in a particular instructor he worked with, coach he's worked with since he was 10. He's his hitting coach in baseball. And I started to study this guy. I would go and watch his lessons. I'd watch him with my son. I'd watch him with some other players. And what I thought was really neat is this guy could really key in on a couple things. Number one, how to handle that player and communicate with them properly. Number two, kind of differentiated instruction. So he's not going to go in and teach every single kid the same thing. He could really figure out what that particular kid needed to get better. And I think those two things combined, he really was effective as a coach because I would see the improvement in those kids. And I know my son valued that type of coaching to the point where I think he's got a strong understanding now as a high schooler of what good coaching is and poor coaching. And at times he hasn't been afraid to go into the office and sit down with the coach and talk to him about what he's thinking, some of the communication, some of those other things, which I think is tough for an athlete. I don't think every kid is comfortable doing that, which is, I think, problematic because at some point that coach needs to get some feedback too. So in terms of that, I mean, what are your thoughts on what we can pick up from on our athletes in terms of their perception and how they're seeing us? Because I think a lot of coaches just aren't aware of where they're at, or maybe some of them don't care. But I would think for the most part, they're probably not aware of how those athletes are perceiving them.
Well, I think based on your story, I think what you're kind of getting at perhaps is that your son was able to go into the office. I think that's a pretty good indicator, like you said, that there has been a rapport developed. There is a little bit of a trusting relationship that is a kind of a two-way street there. And I think it would be a good indicator that some rapport and trust has been developed. And obviously there's many strategies that you can do to kind of facilitate that. But I think that would be one indicator. And you're right. I'm not sure that's the only tell-all indicator that you've developed some rapport. But I think that would be one indicator if athletes are coming in to talk shop about different things that are happening within technical and tactical skills. But then also, you know, how am I developing coping strategies to reduce stress or increase my confidence or develop my routine better to increase my confidence when I'm up at the plate, or in football, it would be to enhance my performance in different ways. So those are my thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think you too, that I do think it's unusual for a young person, a teenager there to, what I might call self-advocate, to go in and talk to the coach. I'm going to assume perhaps then that they do, again, have some type of trust and not worried about being yelled at or degraded. The coach is going to be open and try to facilitate his development and growth. You know, that's the type of things you want to see. And you often see it at the elite level because, too, again, those athletes have developed those coping skills and those advocacy skills to try to get better. We've talked about before with, I think it's the Tampa Bay Bucks defensive end, that his message was to...
Yeah, Gerald McCoy, right.
Yeah, it was to hear the message, not the tone. The challenge there is that the tone itself can be very debilitating, too. So if a coach is constantly yelling at you or degrading you or challenging you without also picking you up, right? It's not that you can't have high expectations and challenge people. It's you've also got to pull them aside and give them a hug. Coach Fulmer used to say, sometimes you got to know when to kick them in the pants and other times you got to know when to give them a hug. Right, that's what the research says too. That's actually what Becker's research says, that not in quite in that language, but that you are going to be individualized and appropriate at appropriate times. That after years of experience and reflection, developing empathy and interpersonal skills, that you're going to know, like, hey, I can't just keep on grinding on this guy and beating him down without also saying, here's why I'm doing this. Here's the expectations. Here's why this is important. Here's why this is going to help get you better. And providing that big picture of the program's philosophy, the coach's philosophy and vision. So these things go hand in hand. And I want to offer one really, I think, useful tool for coaches to think about. And it's actually in a book called Caring by Nell Noddings. And it's the term she uses is called motivational displacement. And I probably read this book 15 years ago, and it was about teachers and educators, not about coaches. So motivational displacement is kind of what it sounds like. It's displacing your own motivations for somebody else's. And if you are caring for somebody, and Noddings gives the example of like a mother and child rearing, you're caring for the baby and you're addressing their needs over yours. And so I think it's an interesting thing to think through and use as a concept for coaches to, what are these athletes, what are they thinking, what are they feeling on the field? What's their experience? What's it like when they're trying to get better, or somebody in their family's in their ear, or they're having struggles at home, or what do they really want? What do they really need? And how do I know those things? And I think as coaches, we tend to assume that the athletes are there to go professional. They all have great expectations to be college level scholarship athletes. And the reality is they don't. And then very quickly too, we tell them, look, the chances of you actually getting a scholarship and going pro are slim to none. And so again, what are we doing, especially with the young kids, if we're developing good relationships and fun and care and support and really skill building ways to strengthen psychologically, mentally, emotionally, physically, then those are the outcomes and that's what's going to bring them back. If they're getting yelled at and hurt, again, they're smart enough, I think, a lot of times to get the heck out of there and not put themselves in those situations. So hopefully motivational displacement can help somebody think about what does the other person need here. And if I have a conversation, if I pass out a piece of paper, if I use technology in an email or an app nowadays, you know, all those are different tools to help you get a piece of the puzzle of what's going on.
I think, too, I was thinking of some of the research on that perceptions again, and it seems like athletes don't necessarily say, again, in general, across like multiple athletes, they don't say that my perception of my coach is going to get me to the next level. Now, granted, I mean, some of them may have that goal, but we don't see those things. It's fun, enjoyment are some of those other characteristics of what they're doing, and we're not seeing that. My coach is going to get me to the next level.
What the athletes want and what their reasons for participation are often different or not what we assume. They want to learn skills. They want to have friends, especially teenagers. Interpersonal skills and friendships in schools and high schools is hugely important. And that's why bullying is such a bad thing and has such a devastating impact too, because their peer-to-peer influence is a huge factor in their lives right at that point.
You know, in just listening to you guys talk about that and those athletes who do have that motivation to get to the next level, is there something maybe we can gain, I guess, in their perception of us if they feel the need to be going out and, you know, getting specialized coaching? I know some of it is we're regulated. We can't always work with them, but then we see, I think both good and bad, we see guys who go out and work with other coaches specializing in a skill development type of thing, but then maybe they start to hear that voice too much as well. What can we learn from some of that? Or is it too generalizing to say that should be telling us something?
It's a great modern day kind of dilemma that coaches are dealing with. The rise of the private coach, as well as the parent or some agent type of person whispering in their ear, go to this camp, you know, work with this, you know, specialist. This is where you're really going to get it, you know. And sometimes they do that almost like negative recruiting. They'll start talking down the high school coach, perhaps at that kid's school, and say, well, this is the private school or this is the private coach that you really need to go see. So it's a challenge. I mean, I think as a coach, too, I want to understand what the specialist is doing. They're just a quack or a guru, and the word gets out that they're really not producing great technique or doing things that they should be doing, or you see them using a variety of gadgets and technology, and they're trying to sell somebody really on the brand and the product, not the quality of instruction and not the experience itself, too. I sympathize with this coach on that. I can tell you from my research and my dissertation that a few of the athletes talked about going to see a coach or an old coach that they had. Right. And you think about this one. Here's another curveball. If I'm in the NFL and I don't particularly care for my position coach, maybe I go back to my college and I go find my position coach at the college that I had either a better relationship or I thought he was a better, more knowledgeable coach and had more information to offer. Now you're kind of thinking that you've got two great coaches competing versus each other. Mm-hmm. And what do you do? What do you do in that scenario? So I think I'll leave it to this and go, at least when I coached football and I knew that I didn't know much about football, coaching football in a weight room and coaching speed was different. But if we could have a guy come in or there was an older athlete we didn't have any local specialists or gurus and that kind of stuff and the football skills. But I might be open and bring them in and try to learn from them and share and communicate and at least know what's going on and how. The other option, too, that guys do is to say none of that exterior outside coaching. Gymnastics, but my son's gymnastics gym, you're not allowed to get external outside coaching without prior approval. And in this way, it helps the coaches. Does it give them more control? It does. Is that inherently bad? Not necessarily. They're actually really good coaches. They've been around for years, got degrees in coaching, and they've got lots of very high-quality athletes performing. So I think part of their concern is the parents as well as the kids. You know, the kids not so much, but the parents and others that say, hey, you should go down the road to the, you know, here at Colorado Springs, or you should go see this coach or go work with this athlete, and they're going to give you the magical tune-up. And that may not be in the best interest of the kids, too.
I know when I look at some of the guys who I guess are best in that regard, the private coaches, that they work really hard to be sure that, number one, they're not stepping on toes, that they're not saying something that can really put that athlete in a bad position and make him feel like he's in conflict with that other coach. I know I've been out to sessions here with, and he's been on my podcast, Jim Ballard, who is in College Football Hall of Fame and does a really good job working with quarterbacks. But when I go out and watch his sessions, and my nephew trained with him, and I've just gone out there to see what he's doing, I see a lot of the high school coaches around too, that they're there and kind of learning and getting that support as well, that he leaves it open to them to essentially be able to understand what he's working with these guys on and maybe help them integrate some of those ideas into what they're doing. So I think when you can find that situation where there's that give and take and it's about essentially doing what's best for the athlete as well as helping the coach develop professionally, I think you have a win-win situation. But I know that might be exception in this case and not the norm. And I don't mean to go down a rabbit hole on this concept, but I think the whole idea is understanding those perceptions of our athletes. And we're going to get into our next episode on more on what can we do to develop as coaches to be more effective in our coaching. But in regards to this topic, the perception of athletes, I guess how would you guys summarize and tie this up, and what does it look like in practical application?
I think in part with coaches, it's get out of your own way too, just like we would tell an athlete. A lot of coaches think they have to be like superheroes as well. And it's okay to be honest, and it's better to be honest about where you're at. You know, especially if you're a young coach or you're coming into coaching career change. Just be thirsty and learning and being open to learning and trying to really synthesize and go out and coach guys and practice and see if they're getting better. Being great in instruction as a technician, football is so important. And then how you convey that information. You can look at the motor learning literature and how to offer feedback and figure out what cues are going to work, right? And if you go from college to college or high school to high school, you can hear a lot of coaches giving similar cues. Watch this, foot positioning here, three steps back, push off like this. But giving the feedback and then not yelling at guys, constantly picking them up, offering some praise about what they're doing right and encouragement, talking to them about what's going on the field and goal setting as well as off the field. I think those very basic, fundamental interpersonal communication skills of showing positive regard and support. And again, that doesn't mean you give them everything. It means you can question, you can challenge, you can make them reflect and have them seek out answers as well and involve them in decision-making and have high expectations for everybody. That's another thing in the literature too, that sometimes coaches have different expectations of people, and those expectations then influence the coach's behavior and the athlete's response.
And you can do those things in a positive way too.
Yeah.
Or you can do it in a negative way, which is kind of the difference, you know, perhaps between the two.
Yeah. And saying it, coaches tend to often, you know, and this is where we didn't really define microaggressions, but, you know, microaggressions, saying these small little subtle put downs that may incorporate some, you know, racial or ethnic or gendered kind of ways of talking, degrading language, name calling, using humor. Humor can be a dangerous thing too.
Yeah, especially sarcasm. Yeah.
Yeah. And kids don't get that. And kids are already so, I don't want to say sensitive and they're snowflakes and that kind of stuff, but they're constantly getting a barrage of things at school, and kids need to learn how to communicate to other people. And it's pretty hard nowadays to find somebody that's going to sit there and not only want and your verbal abuse, but be in a situation where they're going to tolerate that for an extended period of time. Hopefully most people get out of abusive relationships. So the same thing, you're not helping anybody by yelling at them over time. Better ways to communicate and pack a message.
So the final kind of thing for me is when we were talking, I mean, Keith, you mentioned this lifelong learning, and I was remembering a paper that of Olympic level athletes and their perceptions of effective coaching. And that was another characteristic that has kind of been weaved through our discussion here today, but it wasn't kind of explicitly discussed as a perception that even Olympic level athletes, they perceive their coaches as being lifelong learners and planning effective strategies and continuing to modify them and learn both from the athlete and from others. Similarly, how you were talking about how coaches were out observing the quarterback coach specialist in that regard. And then kind of to wrap it up, I think it's great that you started off with that original story, and that's kind of this integration between understanding and knowing how to develop tactics, but then also these softer skills, these life skills in coaches, and it's that integration of the two. And I think based on some of the other podcasts that we've talked about and how these kind of are overlaid, the general theme is, yes, we want to develop tactics and we need to develop character and all these things. And sometimes we may feel like just don't have time to do them, but we can, I think, and coaches can embed some of those things that they already do that are developing technical and tactical skills with that positive reinforcement, developing rapport, trust, character building, and developing those life skills integrated within drills and activities that you're doing on a normal basis. So adding those things on and seeing how and where I can kind of help develop rapport and trust and cohesive units within those drills and activities that we're doing on a daily basis.
I'll jump in and add one quick thought, summarize Keith, a couple of things. And Clay mentioned some of the research on Olympic athletes. So this touches on that specialized coach, Keith.
Mm-hmm.
And that Olympic athletes that were successful in the Olympics had talked about their Olympic coach is not always the same coach that they train with, right?
Right.
And sometimes people don't realize that when you go to the Olympics, you might not have at that time your particular coach. Your coach might be there in the stands, but it's not the designated Olympic coach. What the athletes preferred, what they thought was successful, was the Olympic coach who didn't come in and try to be rah-rah, I'm going to handle everything and it's going to be my way or the highway. They wanted the Olympic coach to be more like a facilitator and a liaison to how the athlete had been coached, to the skills and techniques that they had developed. So in a way, that Olympic coach displaces their needs for the athletes, and the Olympic coach then can be a conduit and a communicator between all the parties. And in a different way, too, it takes pressure off of that coach to have to all of a sudden be, you know, the best technician and decision maker ever, and that they're helping the athlete and the coach, the other coach, too, kind of work together as a team approach to where it's going to be in the best interest of the individual athlete and the Olympic team, the U.S. team in this case. So that's how it all can kind of work together in a different way.
Guys, I think this was a great start to essentially what is a kind of a two-part series here. In the next episode, next week, we're going to focus more on the coach side of this and what we can start to think about and do to develop ourselves towards being effective coaches. And it certainly is a continuum. It's not something that I think you ever hit that end point that, okay, I reached it, I'm done. I'm done learning, I'm done growing. I think it's something we have to constantly work at. And I think these podcasts, especially how we position them at the end of the week, should be a pause for some reflection on how we're doing and the things we're doing. And hopefully in this case today, maybe we spurred some thought on what are your athletes really thinking of you at this point as you're around the midpoint or across the midpoint of the season. So we'll pick this up next week, guys. It was great to talk to you again here, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thanks, Keith.
Thanks, Keith. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.